move on to the Q&A and comments session, which we've allotted about 40 minutes. Fine, okay, we'll be perfect time for it. So I would like to open the floor up, and this is your opportunity to ask questions and make comments to either of the speakers. So if you'd like to raise a hand or stand up. Yes, sir.
Can I ask a question to both speakers?
Has
secularism evolved from trial and error? If so, how much impact have the errors had on past generations that have been under secularism?
Again, so the secularism that I'm talking about and I guess defending is quite a minimal concept. If you look at somewhere like Britain, I'm not able to sort of say this is a politically secular country in and of itself. So I don't even think that it, which people tend to describe as a relatively secular country. I don't think we have the exact principles, but I'm not that prescriptive set. So I'm not really sure where I would say. I mean, certainly in somewhere like Denmark, I would say, Sweden, they're slightly better at maintaining that sort of church-state separation, to put it in a very traditional way. I think it's important to focus that, this is slightly an aside from the question, but on the idea of Britain and secularism, obviously we have the head of state is also the head of Church of England, which is a pretty symbolic and fairly empty stepping over the line of secularism. We also have 26 bishops sat in the House of Lords as of the right, the only Western democracy to do that, to have anything like religious figures, purely because they are religious figures at the top of society. And obviously that does affect legislation in quite, it's not just a symbolic thing. 26 people in the House of Lords all generally sort of voting pretty much in a block, arguing in the same direction. That has a pretty big impact. They're not there because they've been elected, they're not there because of merit necessarily, they've been put there by the church, and I think so it's just important to say, you know, maybe we don't have it right here.
Let's ask, how many people are there in the House of Lords in total, do you know?
No.
A
couple hundred. I mean, it's only a small percentage. There's quite a lot, but not three or four hundred.
Alright, secularism from its inception. From its inception, it was revolutions, bloody. You had the Reign of Terror in France, for example, under Robespierre. You had a megalomaniac come out from Napoleon. You had Britain's march towards secularism and limiting the power of the monarchy and so on, obviously, which is in the English Civil War and the sometimes also bloody Glorious Revolution, which happened in England as well. But then it's not just the death toll it took to create secularism, it's what happened afterwards, not just measured in death and blood, but also in, for example, quality of life. For example, you had the War of Independence, where America tried to separate itself from England, and then it suddenly called this a freedom and democracy, freedom and democracy, but England was already kind of, it championed itself, it prided itself rather in being a free country, and enlightened values and ideals and so on. But the biggest gift of secularism to humanity is nationalism, the detachment of divine authority to a geographical region, the divine right of kings, which happened in the West, and like with it, the Pope who tried to control Europe and stop it fighting itself, but using Christianity. Say, don't fight each other, Jesus doesn't like it, and I'm the Pope, and I'm infallible, so you have to do what I say, so don't fight. When people separated God from state, then they found they had economic interests that lied or was obstructed by their fellow neighbors, and so they probably decided to massacre each other until they were in a one-on-one or they reached some kind of détente or what have you. And you had many, many years of wars in Europe. It's funny because there was wars in Europe between different Christian factions which caused the kind of secularism to arise, and then after secularism was established, there was many, many more wars, but this time not over religion, not over a divine prophet, just over profit, money itself. And I mean, the amount of things which has happened, you had the slave trade, which I know people will say, oh, but they were pushing to everything that, but they were doing it under an understanding of material benefit, the material benefit of exploiting, let's say, workers. And ironically, it was a religious man using religious principles who basically urged against it. One could argue they were two sides of the same coin in liberalism, or they were two sides of the same coin in Christianity. Whichever it was the case, the arguments put forward by the capitalists were that it's good for money, you know, and so on. So you had many of those things. And up until today now, the issue of secularism, well, I'm not going to recount the whole history of it, but the most recent problem with secularism happens in the credit crunch, due to free market economic system, whereby the state doesn't want to control you and gives you freedom. Well, then the bankers decided basically that they developed the fiat system, not based on anything solid or objective, paper money with intangible confidence and interest rates, because you're free to do it. It's your property. You want to charge someone money for lending them, who are poorer than you, concentration of wealth, so on, so on, and so forth. You end up with the kind of credit crunch, all because of the unrestricted freedoms. Ironically, now the government is talking about more enhanced regulation of that. Whenever I mention these things, and obviously my colleague says, well, you've given some great arguments for reform. Yes, but we're reforming freedoms. You're limiting freedoms here. If you want to say, well, no, unrestricted freedoms, let's make some lines between people's freedoms, not related to physical harm, but now related to money transactions, now related to what you can say and what you can do. These are the lines being drawn. It's not now related to physical harm. So these are the issues which I'd say are the current gifts of secularism to humanity. But
if I can I read it? Come back on that. Let's not go into the whole too much into historical thing. I mean, I find it very odd the idea that somehow the divine right of kings and the Vatican have always sort of maintained order, and then the secularists came along and blew everything up wholly. I mean, you earlier were talking about the sort of Christian Dark Ages, and certainly, you know, the divine right of kings, that did not stop at borders. That, you know, Britain has been covered for 3,000, well, was covered for a long time in wars precisely between kings, all of whom, well, not all of whom, but a lot of whom would be claiming a divine right of some sort of, I mean, things have got been done in the name of states with slightly secularist principles underneath them. I think the idea of sort of arguing by body count, I find a bit odd. There's always something else going on, whether it's religious war or a secularist war. It's always more complicated than that. And I think that trying to sort of pin things down to just one little black and white assumption is disconcerting. I think when it comes to what you're just saying then about law reform and so on, again, the secular state is not an anarchical state that only has secular principles in how its laws are formed and how its civic arena is managed. It has laws other than that, and of course those will include laws about transactions of money, and sometimes those laws aren't going to be right. I completely disagree with the idea that the credit crunch is in some way secular or secularistic in origin. It was allowed by laws that weren't changed that are purely economical. It has nothing to do with the underlying notion that in a secular state, in an open society, we can't form the laws with public rationale in the civic arena.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions? The lady there, please. Thank you.
I have a question for Abdullah. One of the things that has been interesting to hear as you guys have been debating is that you actually have a lot of things in common. So you're both talking about the importance of people being able to sort of be themselves to a certain degree, and negotiating, you both use that word, sort of having the ability to sort of negotiate what is, what the law should be. And Bob has acknowledged that he's not advocating for an atheist state. And so given that, what it would be helpful if you could sort of say, if you were to change England as a state, for instance, what would it look like that would be different? What would, you know, what is the real, from a positive point of view, like what would it actually look like?
I hesitate to ask that question mainly because if I do, the son will find the video, edit it, and then it'll just be having saying, England should be this, front page news, I'm the new Anjum Chowdhury. New face of Alma Hajjum. Sorry, it's an extremist group. About them. Well, basically, how to change? And you know what? The commonality between me and Bob here is in, I guess, the English language. And what I mean by this is the terms we use. We both believe in justice. We both believe in equality. But, like I mentioned before, from the philosopher Fish, who said that it means different things to different people. Equality means, you know, how to define it, how to define justice. What is it? You know, people have, I mean, you know, political philosophers, I mean, just go into the local, you know, bookshop and look at, you know, political philosophy, and you'll find hundreds of books all contradicting each other by secular philosophers arguing over the issue of ethics, of political ethics, of equality, of justice, and so on, so on, so on, so forth. Even within the same schools of thought, so to speak, amongst, let's say, the modern-day liberals, political liberals, they would argue against, some argue against John Rawls, who's like one of the preeminent ones, preeminent guys. So I guess the real, I think, basis here, what I'm trying to show by showing here these contradictions, is anything that has a contradiction within it, there must be a problem. And I'm arguing that it's the root of secularism is the problem. And we keep trying to rearrange the top half, but it's the root which is the problem, which is how we give freedoms out, and we just say the freedom of the individual. And then suddenly, after implementation, we realize that people actually start like hurting each other in non-physical ways, or even in ever-increasing physical ways. I was going to give out some statistics over the amount of rapes that happen every year in England. It's only rising, and it's rising beyond the population rise, which happens, for example.
I think the lady was saying, what would be your vision of society? What laws would actually change, rather than criticising secularism? What would be a positive Islamic version of the discussion?
Well, it's a big question. I guess I was just trying to explain where I'm coming from before I just start saying, well, this should be like this, 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 this. Essentially, I believe in society, which I would like to see in England, a society based on equity, which is essentially those who have a surplus are basically help those who have a deficit, essentially, in many different angles. It can be economically, it can be, for example, obviously, if this person is disabled, but it can also be other ways as well, such as, I would argue that women should be have more modest attire, and the reason why I argue that is mainly because there is an effect of between two genders, even though they're not physically, you know, they're not necessarily physically hurting each other. If, for example, women are having certain reproductive organs displayed, for example, or at least alluded to by their dress. But it causes an emotional effect in the other gender, which creates a social tension. I know it's not PC to say this, but I say as it is. It causes a kind of a emotionally frustrated effect in society as a whole. When you have billboards and TVs and magazines and stuff, people say, oh, if you've got a problem, why don't you look down? Yeah, but like if I'm on the train, look down, it's even worse. Blow the waist, even worse. On the top of the sky, straight up. And that's the problem, you see? But because, according to secular theory, they don't recognize the intangibles of human emotion, which I would argue Islam does deal with. But I was going to turn this debate into an Islamic debate, but essentially I would argue for equity, and whereby all people's human nature, all their instincts and drives are kind of directed in such a way that they don't frustrate each other and don't cause problems to each other, or incite people to be frustrated against each other.
So if there were a version of secularism, and maybe the word secularism is not even appropriate, but if there was a version where the intangibles, so I think that's a really good point, intangibles were taken into consideration, then it would be more palatable to you, is the first question. The second is, what if there are some things that, you know, women are affected by men, just haven't been explored? So who is to be the judge of that, and what is the basis for that? In a society that is pluralistic and where there are different things?
Well, pluralistic, I mean, if it's different religions, then fine, but we're both different competing theories of political system. How to deal with that? It's either one, you know, there's only about three major ones, it's either one or the other, essentially. But back to what you said, I just use the issue of women and men as example, or men being as an example. There is also effective women, I know that, yeah? And I know that that also has to be addressed. I just gave a more well-known example, because everyone knows that example. And so everyone knows that Islam kind of commands on this issue of hijab, because that's so well-known, I gave it as an example. But I would say that Yeah, secularism could say, well, well, today we believe in intangibles, but perhaps you have the communitarians, a communitarian new kind of, well, relatively new kind of offshoot, which ask calling for a more community-based focus rather than individualistic-based focus. And they criticize people like rules and political liberals. The problem with this is still, where do you set the barriers? What human nature, well, A, what is human nature, firstly, which is a big problem. If you don't have a basis for what creates humans and where they live and what they're meant to be doing, how can you define what, how they should be fulfilling their human nature? And what is the correct way of fulfilling your human nature? You know, because a person can have, for example, reproductive satisfaction with a variety of different things, so to speak. Which one is the one that he, that they should and the state stick to, ones that they shouldn't stick to, and who's going to say that? If you don't have an epistemological basis, if you don't have a religion or whatever to dictate that to you, then it's just purely arbitrary. Which is why I love where communitarians are going, but they just don't have any basis to direct them, and hence that society will fail, as they, and then they'll say, okay, we'll retweak it again, and they'll retweak all the rights again, and they'll keep getting it wrong ad infinitum until, I would argue, they implement a system that is based on a epistemology that addresses human nature, not just any religion.
Thank you. Any more questions or comments? The lady right, then I come to you. The lady right at the back, please.
Hi, I've got a question for Rob. I'm kind of confused as to, because I've actually missed the beginning of your speech. But what I'd like to comment on is, do you believe, first of all, in Darwinism and in Freud, because they're very secular? And if you do, let's look at the fact that they believe in evolution and they believe that the physical and the mental evolves. Now, if we look back into our history, 10,000 years, we will find that each civilization has evolved. Now, let's talk about it mentally. The human being has mentally evolved, and religion has been there fundamentally from the beginning, right? I mean, if we look at, for example, our history of Hammurabi, he set out the laws, and he was motivated by religion and equity. Now, what I'm saying to you and what I'm asking is, let's look at it in terms of a mental element. Can the mind, can the human mind, technically remove itself completely from religion when it's been there, when it's been part of civilization for a period of 10,000 years, if not more? And the secular movement has probably been there for 300 years. How can we say that that is more likely to last when we look at religion and the length and duration that it's been there for?
I don't necessarily think that it is more likely to last, secularism. Yes, I believe in Darwinian evolution by natural selection. Freud had some good points, some not so good points. I think the general principles underlying some of what he said make some sense. I guess it's the intangibles that were referred to before, which I definitely don't think that secularism can deal with intangibles of psychological natures. You talked about a sort of an evolution, you called it a progress of human culture at one point, and then came on to the fact that, like, only 300 years or so we had sort of secular ideals. I would agree with that completely. Obviously, facetiously putting words in your mouth, in that I think we have evolved away somewhat from religion at a broad cultural level. Fewer and fewer people in Britain and across Europe are religious. Growing reform movements across much of the Muslim world. So I think, by all means, talk about a cultural progress. I think it goes in a direction away from those original stages of real superstition, and even now away from the stages of a better, sort of more theologically inclined religion that we are loosening up about what states and morality are, bringing them down to a human level where they are ours, to think about, not to play with and toy with in a relativistic manner, but to build and negotiate with and between us. I think that's what we're evolving towards. So yeah, I think that people are culturally moving away from some aspects of religion. Not everyone, and it's not easy, and it's not like, and I mean, there are cognitive biases that lead us towards, in a very broader sense, superstitious thought. I'm not saying that all religion is reducive to superstition, but it's one aspect that I think underlies the difficulty that people have with letting go of it. I mean, I know I'm talking in terms there that to come back to what we said at the beginning, you're going to be sort of offensive. Like when I talk about progress, I'm sometimes talking about progress away from religion, but that's going to be a natural consequence of my position.
I did ask the gentleman after you to make a question or make a comment.
I just wanted to make a personal point of view and then open it up to a more general one. Mention that without a God or laws to give us a way of behaving, anything is permissible. It's that kind of way of thinking. On a personal level, I've been married for 32 years, disabled. Never been with any other woman, or wanted to. And I'm a humanist or atheist, whatever you call it. But on the other hand, I'm quite happy for other people to behave however they want to. So what I'm saying is I don't need your celestial dictatorship to teach me how to behave. I haven't needed it. Now it's a more general point. You as an individual, some other people here, might find women dressing immodestly make you unable to control yourself, and other people do so. You said it had an effect on you. You don't know where to look, and I understand. I'm not saying it doesn't have an effect on me. I accept that. But you also mentioned, where do you draw the line? So you mentioned dressing modestly. This lady is dressed in a certain way that I would call quite modest. There's another lady at the front who has her head covered, dressed more modestly. You could choose, there are some situations where a lady might just have a slit for her eyes and have her hands covered, and even one where you can't see her eyes at all. Now on a personal level, when I'm sitting on a train opposite someone that's completely covered up so I can't see them at all, I find that very, very uncomfortable. Just giving you my own personal point of view. So it's where to draw the line is rather difficult. And I'd be interested as to how you would know where to draw the line. I'm sorry I haven't been as eloquent as you guys have.
Sure, it's been interesting. All right. Well, I'll say it like this, okay? Say someone doesn't like eating mushrooms. I don't like eating mushrooms, hate them, right? But my friend loves eating mushrooms, absolutely loves it, yeah? But let's say at this restaurant where they serve, the mushrooms are very unhygienically cooked, and so they're really bad. But they always put it next to the plate, we always order, they put mushroom side order. Now for me, you know, my friend, he can't resist it, because I just have a few, it won't hurt me, and so on. But I won't. Now, I don't need to make a conscious that I'm not going to eat these mushrooms, because I don't like it, personally. My friend, if I told him, don't eat those mushrooms, for him, he might say, okay, maybe health-wise, maybe I won't, maybe if I have a few, it won't hurt. So he might go either way. Intellectually, he might go make any kind of considered choice. It doesn't make a difference. Now, it's great, you know, whenever, not to kind of talk about ages, but some people have encountered, whenever we talk about morals, they say, yeah, I have a point, yes, I am 10 times better than Mother Teresa. I give out my blood every single day to a random passing stranger who needs it and what have you, and so it's all great, it's wonderful, but it doesn't disprove or prove anything. All it shows is, A, that you're a product of the society you came from, and there you go, fine, you know. We have a subconscious and a conscious. The conscious is our intellectual capacity, our unconscious, we have our drives and motivations, and the morals reside in atheists, and they're unconscious, so to speak. They're taught from a young age, and they kind of feel the morals. And so you didn't have any feeling to go and cheat on your wife. That's great. But what about the man who does have a feeling to go cheat? Well, maybe he doesn't like his wife, maybe there's a beautiful girl that's enticing him, and he thinks, why not? Why not? That's literally, why not? If my wife doesn't know about it...
Because it would hurt his family.
Yeah, just because you can't think of a reason doesn't mean that an atheist can't think of a reason. I think this notion comes up so much in debating sort of morality from an atheist viewpoint. The idea that we, in some sense, can't possibly... It's unconscious. If I behave well, obviously I'm not acting on principle, because you don't think that there's an underlying philosophical way of getting to it. Well, no, I think that I actually have a principle. And it's a very frustrating sort of de-rationalization of the way that other people are thinking. It seems to not be trying to get to an understanding of that different way that we think about morality.
No,
it's something we build and construct, sure.
But sure, but you misunderstood. Like, you know, you could, no offense to Nick, let's say, for example, let's say a Christian, let's say an evangelical, let's say, a Pentecostal, they've seen Jesus, they have a Jesus experience, or what have you. Now, you could go and sit down with them and rationalize, is Jesus God? Did he, let's say, do the miracles? He said he does. It's a book. How do you know it's true? You could sit down and rationalize this person, but they will never change their viewpoint because their concept. It might not be rationally grounded, and they say, I don't care, there's no proof. I believe it. I feel it.
Sorry, I thought you were a Christian convert.
Yes,
change your mind about the fundamental aspects of your religion.
Yeah, rationally, I questioned it. I questioned the basis. But I'm saying that an atheist can believe in a moral and feel it's right, but not necessarily be able to explain it in a debate why this moral must be followed. And so, what this categorical imperative is can't put it. Why you must follow it. Maybe they can't give it, they can't explain it. They say, well, it's the right thing to do. I feel it's the right thing, and I know that. And that's what they'll explain, and I don't doubt it. It's a concept you hold intellectually and internally, but it's the justification. And I'm asking, what about the person, the man, who says, like I did when I was 14, how do I know for sure? Why what am I believing is true? Or why should I follow it? And it's that case, that human beings have this intellect, that they will question the basis of this moral, and they'll find it empty if you're naked, that there is no, as long as you survive, have a good life, and procreate, and what happened, then that's all great. And I say, and just to finish the last point, because I think I got sidetracked.
Let's go on to the questions.
Yeah, the issue of, I can't control myself. Well, I'm still here, so I haven't been locked up by the police or anything yet, so obviously I have controlled myself.
Well done. Right. The night is young. The gentleman with the...
Providing the Quranic evidence that God ordered hijab, is that relevant to discussion?
You don't have to answer if you don't want to. Start as much time as you want.
After the debate, okay. We can discuss that.
Can I just say, it's like a sidetrack. Then we kind of drown in particulars. We should probably speak about the general theme of tonight's debate.
Do you have any comments or questions on the general theme of
tonight's debate? Well, okay, just going back to the analogy. About the table being objective. And then you drew upon that and said that we have the same kind of discussions about morality. The problem with that analogy is, it's not analogous, so that's what my contention is, and that is that one is of a description and the other one is a complete different realm of knowledge, which is to do with ought and not. So you can't draw an analogy with what you said.
I talked about the table as an example of one kind of objectivity.
And you said that it's not to do with, that objectivity doesn't actually give you a sense of truth of morality. Well, I would disagree with that point, because I think if we don't have an objectivity, if we don't have a transcendent advantage point, then all that happens is that morality is subjective expression is a personal taste, then which reduces and relegates our discussion about morality to a realm of appreciation. So I like ice cream, you don't. No one is actually right. In the sense that the proposition that chocolate ice cream is the best ice cream in the world, or the most tastiest ice cream, is not really objectively true. It's subjectively true. So if morality is then not objective, and then relegated to a realm of, subjectivism, then how can it ever be true?
From a humanist point of view, it's very sad to talk about relegating things down to this, the real world that we share. I mean, I quite like this place. I don't think it's somewhere that morality is forced to be retreating to. It's where I think it exists, and it comes back to obviously we have this different notion. In a sense, it is a kind of a reduction. I don't believe that morality is latching onto an external world. I think that it's objective in the sense that it's about here and now. These intangible things that we were talking about before. You know, if I hurt someone, well, that contradicts a value that I have decided to hold. And you know, it objectively hurts someone. It's not like, do I like ice cream? It really is like, you know, oh, I pulled the wings off a fly, that hurt it. And you know, we actually think all the times about this pure, plain, natural world without reference to a spiritual dimension in very value-laden, normative terms. I mean, the example I often use is health. Health, and if I break my arm, something's bad has happened. I now have some ill health. If I get a disease, I'm in ill health. These are negative terms. I can be fit and healthy. These are positive terms. They're not just mere descriptions. They are normative in and of themselves. I think that through health, not even as an analogy, actually, as a sort of, for me, there's a sort of notion of the overall health of the system or the world, to which my moral endeavours, ideally, obviously, I'm not like brilliant all the time, but yeah, to which they are oriented, a very objective set of things about the real world. And it's, obviously, that means there's going to be a lot of scope for debate and disagreement about what counts as healthy in a particular circumstance, how you get there, but isn't that exactly what we see?
What I would say to that is, well, firstly, I know you say that you want to bring it down to this level.
And I think it is at this level.
It is at this level, but that doesn't mean that it's objective. That's a statement, it's not an argument. And the second point I'd like to say is that by making another analogy about health, that's prudential interest, not moral interest. Those are two separate realms, again. Like, for example, if I run to catch the bus, I'll pretty likely get to the bus. That's a prudential interest. That's not a moral interest at all. So again, I just don't see why your analogy is presenting an objective morality.
I just think that it can latch off concepts of, in the very broadest sense, health. So for example, this notion of an intangible mental harm. You've caused a harm to someone, because I mean, I don't know what to think about. Yeah, we do call it mental health. So you've inflicted something on someone which is against the way that their body wants to be. Obviously, it's with their body and mind. And it's very different for different people. But about the objectivity of the world. Well, when I say it based on, I mean, I think the world is real. So in that sense, yes, my humanist morality is very much objective, in that it's about what it affects out there in the world, what values I can perceive out there in the world, the objective real world.
Okay, back to the real world. We have to vacate this place by 9 o'clock. And as each speaker has been invited at the beginning, as I mentioned, to give a 5-minute summation, we have to, unfortunately, end the Q&A at this point. So I'm sorry, not everyone's had the opportunity. So thank you for your questions and comments. I'd like to invite Bob to make his closing remarks for 5 minutes, and then after we'll give his closing remarks for 5 minutes as well. Thank you.
One particular example of a case for radical Muslim theocracy centers around this distinction between the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world, or sometimes the kafir or whatever. This state of, often there's a distinction made, like, we actually don't want to touch non-Muslim world. That's just one approach of a radical political Muslim, but within the Muslim world, where that is, we want to create a state, or there is a state, or I want to improve on a state, that can have Sharia law as the basis for civic law. It works because the Quran was passed down by God, Sharia law was ultimately derived from that, and so on. And you've got this other argument that at one level, an organization cannot make rules for itself, that people cannot make rules, laws for people, God has to do that. Well, obviously, I don't think that the Quran is special in that sense. I don't think it's divine. Again, obviously, this is an implicit consequence of my world view. Let me hash that out in my own terms for a moment. Almost every world religion has remarkably similar stories about a great man performing impossible divine feats, whose wisdomous words are transmitted wholesale and uncorrupted. only the followers of that particular religion, or indeed that particular sect, can see that this, that the work produced is unique. It is, we have, it's special access. I can read it, and this definitely, obviously, is the word of God. There is something infallible about it. Or, you know, if it was constructed by followers, it's still got that spark left in it of divine faith. I've seen this pattern too often. If you're in a religion itself and you start from a certain percepts about the unique qualities of your divine book, then it's obviously very difficult to break out of that pattern. But if you look at other religions and go, well, hang on a minute, Buddhists, not like the Western Buddhists, but like proper Buddhists, they have pretty much the same story about exactly how their particular writing came down. It's also divinely beautiful in a way that no one else can see. I think when you take a step back and try and look comparatively from a standpoint outside of the religions, it's very difficult to see what special nature it has. So obviously, basing the state on this presumed special nature is not something that a lot of people, anyone who basically isn't in a Muslim or isn't in a particular type of Muslim, is going to find that very difficult to get on board with. Just to very briefly mention, there's a worrying flip side in this argument about Muslim states, which, as I mentioned, is this notion of that sometimes comes out. It hasn't come out here tonight, but in the non-Muslim countries, like, there's a certain standoffishness to the political realm there. So you see this argument again and again that either it's the kafir or it's not the state. Don't legitimize the Western democracy. Don't participate. You've then given them a ticket in order to do things in your name. You know, it's a very sort of common argument. And I think that people should be very suspicious of any attempt to disenfranchise them from the country that they're living in. Democracy is not perfect, it's not always easy to cast your vote, it's not always easy to take part, but there are lots of ways of taking part. And to me, it's an incredibly worrying notion that you should not participate. Finally, I'd just like to, because obviously it's been said, there's secularism, I'm an atheist, and there's Muslims, and theocracy, I wanted to just quote from Tamina Karzai, whose text I found, an article I found on the British Muslims for Secular Democracy website, and I want to finish on that. In terms of civil liberties, secular democracy provides safeguards for freedom of expression, e.g. Article 10 of the Human Rights Act. The Prophet, peace be upon him, strongly encouraged people to speak out against injustices. He ordered the one who sees an evil to change it physically with his hand if he was able to do so. If he could not, he should change it by his tongue, by advising and or condemning, and finally, by detesting it with his heart. And he informed that this is the weakest level of faith, detesting with his heart. Unfortunately, in many countries with majority Muslim populations, this kind of active citizenship does not exist, as dissidents are often tortured and even killed for daring to criticize their government. Whatever the faults of Western governments, we at least have a system of checks and balances to protect ourselves from tyranny. Sometimes the laws are not implemented according to our expectations, but at least we have a litany of representative public interest groups speaking out on our behalf of all citizens, regardless of faith, race, or creed. Thank you.
Okay. So only a few points very briefly. Basically, I show that why I believe I've presented to you in my case that why I believe that secularism has arbitrary values which are just basically put out there for belief. It's not value neutral, as like it claims. It has values. That's the whole point with debating secular values. It has values which it has adopted and it will impose on all its constituent components. For example, Bhikkhu Palit, philosopher of political theory at the University of Hull, said, "Multiculturalists such as Kimlicker, Walzer, and myself argue that all groups within liberal society should conform to such liberal values as individual choice and equality, and so on. If certain values are universally valid, no individual can be allowed to consent to their volition." Again, that's great, individual choice and equity, but secularism's definition of individual choice and equality. Maybe a socialist, a communist would say, no, I don't believe in that version. I believe in full economic equality. I reject the libertarianism or liberalism or secularism's concept of it, but it will be imposed on everyone. So that was my point. It's not value neutral. It is arbitrary. It doesn't prevent factionalism. There are factions within secularists.
There are sometimes factions which are violent. There is mob fights, there are riots that happen in secular countries. Nothing has changed in terms of, you know, I think if you compare the number of mobs or riots that happened during the Dark Ages in Europe and among the mobs and riots that happened after that, it'd be the same, roughly the same. There's not really any difference. Factionism, you've swapped religion for nationalism or for self-interest or whatever. So that's what you swapped. Religion's gone out, the prophet of God has gone out, and the prophet has come in. Individualism, what can I say about that? Individualism is a main cause for a lack of cohesion in society because people only consider their own interests. Your purpose of your life is what? To pursue happiness for yourself. Simple. Not for anyone else. Pursue happiness. You might be a great person that loves other people and helps your neighbors and you're still saying that's excellent. But intellectually speaking, epistemologically speaking, the main basis for you, since your observation of life is individual, as in by only yourself, that's your experience of life, only yourself, then that is the only realm of consideration. Which is why you see the rise of crimes due to lack of empathy. You see road rage. Why road rage? Why are you angry if someone cuts you up? That person didn't do it deliberately, he doesn't know you, just some guy on the street or guy in the car. Why? It's because you're angry, they didn't consider you. They didn't consider that you were there, and that's rising. Was it tube rage? Plane rage? All these things are rising. Why is this? I was going to quote loads of stats, I'm not going to bore you. Loads of stats with the rising crime rates in the UK. 167 women are raped every day in the UK, for example. 285,000 people are dangerously addicted gamblers, and so on and so forth. All this is individualism, which comes up thinking of your own interests. And now to finish off the point he made, why is it that within Islam, I don't want to address this because we're talking about theism in general here, but why Islam has this concept of the Muslim and non-Muslim world? It's just a political concept. It's kind of like you have a belief of the free and unfree world, or the communists have a belief of the, you know, communist and the bourgeoisie world, or the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie world. It's just a political understanding of how you map states according to their political ideology. So you have secular West and unsecular wherever, Middle East. But he says that he highlights that Muslims are basically being pacified against dealing with their governments in the Muslim countries. I am all for dealing with our governments in Muslim countries. But you see, that makes me an extremist, according to the definition of the West, who supports these governments, the British government, the American government. And these governments aren't religious. They are secular. Turkey, Tunisia, Algeria. Algeria, famous for massacres against people. Syria, famous again for massacres against people. Iraq, before Saddam Hussein, Ba'athist, secular. These are secular regimes. Saudi Arabia is a virtual secular kingdom with a few Islamic laws, and they like to recite Quran a lot on their TV stations. That's about it. Yeah, they're a kingdom, a secular kingdom. What the king says goes. There are so many, there's interest-based laws in Saudi Arabia, even though interest is prohibited by the Quran. Why is that? It's because it's secular. Egypt, imprisons its people, secular. So my point, actually, what I would like to say is, we shouldn't ask whether God should be de-radicalized, whether religious people should be de-radicalized. Maybe we should tell secularists to keep their belief of their political system to themselves. If you don't want to practice religion, that's fine. But maybe we should ask the question, should secularists be de-radicalized? Thank you.
I'm going to take 45 seconds of your time. I came across this article in this newspaper on the way in today, and it's self-explanatory. It takes 45 seconds to read, and you'll see why it's relevant. Humans are programmed to believe in God because it gives them a better chance of survival, researchers claim. A study into the way children's brains develop suggested that during the process of evolution, those with religious tendencies began to benefit from their beliefs, possibly by working in groups to ensure the future of their community. The findings of Bruce Hood, professor of developmental psychology at Bristol University, suggest that supernatural beliefs are hardwired into our brains from birth, and that religions are therefore tapping into a powerful psychological force. His work is supported by other researchers who have found evidence linking religious feelings and experience to particular regions of the brain. They suggest people are programmed to receive a feeling of spirituality from electrical activity in these areas. These findings challenge atheists such as Richard Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion, who has long argued that religious beliefs result from poor education and childhood indoctrination. Hood believes that it is futile to try to get people to abandon their beliefs because these come from such a fundamental level. Thank you for that. Right, I'd like to thank everyone from persevering with us through to the end this evening. It's been a really interesting discussion, and I hope we'll be all gaining some benefits in terms of knowledge and understanding. As I mentioned earlier, the next MDI debate will be Jihad on Trial. Is Jihad justifiable? In this room, Monday the 26th of October, please go to the MDI website, thedebateinitiative.com for further information, and please don't forget to collect the information leaflets at the back on the right. Thank you very much.